It's Lions, Towers, and Shields from the Incomparable Network. I'm Shelley, your host, and this is episode 41. Welcome back to another discussion of an old movie, sometimes called a classic, but it's always a matter of opinion, isn't it? Today we're talking about All This and Heaven 2, a Bette Davis melodrama from 1940 from Warner Brothers. And I can't do this alone, so I have some special guests with me, beginning with Erica Ensign. Hello.
Hello. Happy to be back. Happy to have watched this movie? Question mark, question mark, question mark, dot, dot, dot.
I always love it when people start out with, what did you get me into? Which is, I think maybe that's what I should rename this show sometimes. Also with us, Lisa Schmeiser. Hi.
Hey, I'm so happy to be here. And I want everyone to know this is now a Barbara O'Neill fan cast.
Yay. I'm not going to argue with you about that at all. Also joining us, Phil, are you a fan of Barbara O'Neill? It's Philip Michaels.
Yes, I am. More to the point, they said I was mad when I when I studied the intricacies of French peerage law.
Doesn't everyone do that? I mean, that's the other Wikipedia page we should all have open, French peerage law. So yes, we're back in 1940, a Warner Brothers film, a Bette Davis melodrama. And this is one of those movies that I'm going to ask all of my panelists to sort of tell me their history, how they ended up watching. I think I know how come Erica watched, because I made it. But I want to know your history with this movie. I will start by saying that it is not a movie. It's a movie I enjoy, but it's not a movie I would have picked to be on this show as, oh, this is going to blow your mind, or this is something really incredibly great or incredibly unusual. It's a movie I like. And when I found out that Phil and Lisa have something of a history with it, I was like, oh boy, this is going to be fun. So let me start with you two. Tell me about your relationship with All This and Heaven 2.
I can't remember if we came. I think we came to this movie after The Toy Wife.
We
is that
did,
right,
we,
Phil?
We did indeed.
Another Barbara O'Neill joint.
This is why. Yes.
Yeah, we sort of backed into All This in Heaven 2 from the Barbara O'Neill Memorial Highway, where one day I was watching Turner Classic Movies. This was sort of back in the days before ubiquitous internet. And The Toy Wife is on, except I didn't see the title, so I don't know what it is. All I know is it's a crazy movie in which people are going, you know, slavery wasn't so bad. And there's a character named Frou Frou, and Barbara O'Neill is there looking put upon. And I said, well, damn, this is the strangest thing I've ever seen. And so...
Transported by the lunatic energy of The Toy Wife.
Yes.
And when we saw the next Barbara O'Neill movie come along, we're like, oh, we have to see if she's going to be the... If she's going to be the sensible anchor around which the drama swirls this time. And we were
she's... We learned of the many ranges of Barbara O'Neill, the ranges being sensible and put upon and crazy.
Yeah. And the funny thing is she played this like right after she played Ellen O'Hara in Gone with the Wind, where she had to be the sensible one while Vivian Leigh was rocketing off of different pillars and posts in every scene. And
obviously like, has a wide age range, too, because Barbara O'Neill, I guess Ellen O'Hara would have been in her late 40s. Barbara O'Neill in real life is early 30s. And, you know, it looks quite beautiful in this movie. I mean, But you guys kept watching this. So you watched All This in Heaven, too. And apparently you've seen it more than once. You've come back.
Oh, yes. So one of the reasons I'm fascinated by this movie is because it misuses Bette Davis so badly. When you have someone like Bette Davis, whose eyes can bore holes through the wall if she directs them in the right way, who has that lovely bittersweet edge to her delivery and comes across as a force of nature, to cast her as this timid French orphan governess who is just buffeted about by the forces of her social betters, it's weird casting. Like, I just keep watching them. I'm perpetually fascinated by the fact that you have Barbara O'Neill, again, regal bearing, queenly good looks, known for being an Oasis of Calm in other movies. You have her playing somebody who's patently unhinged. And then you have Bette Davis, known for now Voyager, known for Jezebel, known for being this steely, forceful presence. You have her as like this timid little type, and I just kept watching going, why? How?
Yes, what? If I told you that there's a movie and there's a character who is just manic and slightly less manic are her two moods, you would go, oh, that's the Betty Davis role. No, friend.
No. Ah, but the Betty Davis role is the starring part, so she had to get that. Well, let me quickly draw Erica in, because I have thoughts on Betty Davis's performance in this movie, too. But Erica, why did you watch this movie with us?
You know, Shelley, if I had infinite time, I would love to be on every single episode of Lions, Towers, and Shields. But time is finite, so I tend to choose movies that either I have seen and I really love, or mm-hmm. ones that look interesting to me or that I've heard of but have never gotten around to seeing. This sort of falls into that latter category. I had not seen it before, but I was like, hey, I like Charles Boyer. I find Betty Davis interesting to watch. I'll give this one a shot. And so here I am. Thanks, guys.
Oh no. Oh. Well, this is going to go well.
I will say I do not regret the time that I spent watching it very much.
So to me, what's interesting about this movie is the weird casting of Betty Davis and her performance, which I think, given the role, she does well, but it's so un-Betty Davis as to be arresting. Like, if you've seen all those other movies, if you've seen now mm-hmm. Voyager and Toy Wife, she's not in that one. Right, I was going to say, Mrs. Skeffington, one of my favorites. If you've seen all those movies and you hear that she's going to be with Charles Boyer in this movie, you're going to be like, oh, this is going to be sort of a Paul Henreid, Betty Davis kind of a deal. And she was, you know, in Now Voyager, she certainly has her timid moments, but she bursts forth and blooms in that movie more so than in this one, differently than in this one. And you think, you know, Charles Boyer, it's going to be a similar sort of, you know, continental man, and they're in Paris, for God's sake, and it's a period piece, and they get to wear, you know, big corsets and stuff. But it's a really unusual performance for her. The weirdest thing about the performance to me, this is such an odd thing for me to say, but the weirdest thing about her performance is that Betty Davis, who has this sort of precise diction with the way she says her T's, she mm-hmm. does that in this movie. She says tis a lot. Tis. And I'm like, what are you doing, Betty Davis? It just doesn't fit your character.
And she starts out with a French accent and then it goes away.
That's
very
true.
Weird.
Yeah, because we start out and she's teaching mm-hmm. these girls French in America, and she has a French accent for a hot minute. And then in the rest of the movie, which is a flashback, I don't know what she's doing.
It's to imply that she's out of place when she's in America, but in France, she's speaking her native tongue.
Fits sure, right
that was,
in.
That was what they were going for.
Yeah.
Just like in Black Widow with all the Russian accents.
Well, we get her back to France, and we even sort of almost start, but completely forget almost immediately this political story about how Betty Davis comes from a family of people who don't have political sympathies with the king, and the people, mm-hmm. and, you know, Charles Boyer and Barbara O'Neill are courtiers essentially, and is he a baron? I forget.
The Duke,
thank you. The Duke,
yes,
that's right.
The Duke and Duchess, yes.
Why did I say mm-hmm. I was forgetting the titles? But then they, like, I thought that was going to be really interesting when Barbara O'Neill's first salvo at Betty Davis is, you know, Your sympathies with the peasants are not going to work out. And I'm like, oh, this is going to be good. And it's just dropped immediately. As so many things in this movie are.
It really is. Well, what was funny was we started watching the movie and our daughter wandered in right at the part where Betty Davis has to, I'm just going to call her Betty Davis. No one cares that her name's all the way out. Betty Davis is busy telling this group of rich little mean girls, you know, we're just going to learn about life today. And we flash back to the Oceanside scene, and our daughter asks in horror, is this movie going to be in flashback? And we see, yes, it is. And she wanders out, and later she wanders in again. And she's all, is it still going in flashback? Yep. Yes, it's a framing device.
Quite literally, the first scene and the last scene pretty much are it's all that's in the present day.
I think my complaint about the framing device of the movie is it sort of takes out the tension with what happens to Betty Davis's character then, because you have a situation that could have been lethal for her. Like the Duchess, can I spoil a movie that's 80
Please
years
do.
Old.
Do you know how much trouble it is to not spoil a movie of this age?
Right.
Come on, people.
Yeah.
Spoiler
alert. So when Barbara O'Neill's, so when the unhappy couple, like, finally consciously uncouples, as it were, and the Duchess gets killed at the hands of her husband, it could have gone really bad for Betty Davis's character, because she's the help. She's implicated in a marital scandal anyway, and now the man she's been linked with has killed his wife. And that could have gone, again, it could have gone really bad in a country where the peers get to do effectively whatever they want and damn the consequences. But you're watching this, and the whole time you're like, she's telling the story in flashback, so she clearly gets out of this somehow, none the worse for wear. So there's a little bit of dramatic...
Would have been a hell of a twist ending if she hadn't. And then I died.
I was brought back to life.
I'm your ghostly French instructor. But there are some weirdly lax moments throughout this movie, and there's some weird storytelling decisions that go on there too. Like you said, the whole thing about the political sympathies is brought up once and then dropped, and there's a lot of interminable scenes with the kids.
Oh, I'm sure we're going to get to the kids. Yeah. I'm sure these are the kind of children that everybody's going to dunk on, and that's fine. I'm with you on it.
You know, I think part of the reason that I don't even know why they bothered mentioning her political sympathies, but I think part of the reason that may have gotten mentioned is the fact that this is loosely based on an actual true story, which I made the mistake of discovering before I watched it. And after I said I'd be on the podcast, but before I watched the movie, I have real trouble watching anything that's even remotely based in truth, because I spend the entire movie going, did that actually happen? Did it work out like that? And I can't undo that little voice in my brain that keeps asking those questions. So instead of being able to just like sink in and enjoy Barbara O'Neill's completely unhinged performance, I'm sitting there going, you know what? I bet in real life that wife was actually totally put upon. She was not crazy. He said she was crazy, and everybody believed him because he was a guy and he was in the peerage. And my mind was just spinning off into other directions while I should have been enjoying her OTTTTT performance.
Well, you bring up something else here too, Erica, that they bring up and then drop abruptly, is it's not a marriage of equals. The Duke had money. The Duke had status, but she had money.
Right, which is initially the source of she's lording that over him, even though she starts out lording it over him, but then pretty soon thereafter she's begging him to get into bed with her. So it's like, you're not doing a good job here, lady. But yeah, they completely drop that.
They drop that. They drop the political stuff all along. And those are two areas that could have been ripe for all sorts of dramatic tension.
When you've got the sizzling hot on-screen love between Charles Boyer and Betty Davis, you have to get right to it.
Apparently.
I'll take your word for it. I didn't see it, and I thought I watched the movie.
Well, and Boyer is interesting because I enjoyed him, and he can be interesting and sexy even, but he didn't do that for me in this movie. And, because you know, Boyer is a middle-aged guy with a receding hairline, even in 1940, and a pretty short guy as well, which is, you know, fine. Short men deserve love too. But
do they though? I feel like I should apologize.
Apparently not. But no, it's well, and where to even go from here? Well, and that,
this was his first movie after, I think, getting out of the French army in 1940, because he was a bit old, as you say, and mostly assigned to clerical work. And so it's possible he did not have his acting fastball back.
Yeah, I don't know if it was so much his acting. I don't know. I mean, I think he performed the part assigned to him pretty reasonably. It is interesting. You know, when he's called on at the very end to kill his wife, you're sort of like, is he going to do it? Is he going to do it? Because the guy we've been hanging out with all this movie doesn't seem like they give him all this rage that comes out in one instant. And again, from a storytelling point of view, it's sort of hard to sort that out. And as you said, Erica, it is based loosely on a true story. It's the story of Betty Davis's character, which is a much longer novel, a story about her life that was made into a novel. But the case at the center of this movie is a small part of it, which accounts for at least some of the loose ends. But yeah, it's concerning that that's the, and a part of the part of what's true apparently is the bit about he's the peer, and he, in an attempt to protect Bette Davis, in an attempt to protect his lover, won't say anything, and so somehow that gets her off, and he gets to take poison and die, but everything's okay. Also, what are those kids that they love so much throughout this entire movie? Now they are not only motherless and fatherless, but, you know, nannyless as well. So there's like nobody in those kids' life.
Yeah, I did kind of wonder what happened to those children at the end of this movie. Like,
they're stuck in Corsica with
I guess,
with the, grandpa
with the grandfather who doesn't seem like he's much fun. But
maybe they join the students who are revolting in Les Miserables, and that's that's what happens.
Sure,
next.
Why not?
Headcanon accepted.
Well, so let's talk a little. Let's enjoy Barbara O'Neill's over the top performance. And the first glimpse we get of her is she's insane. No, that's not right. She's over the top. The insane part we get a little bit later, but she doesn't like her children. She doesn't want to be anywhere near her children. She wants everybody to know that she has the money in the marriage. She also is really hot for her husband, who they take great pains in a sort of a production Cody way to say they haven't really had a marriage for a while, except that one time when she tricked him, I guess. And that's how they had the little boy.
I mean, he tripped and fell, I guess. I don't know.
I hate when that happens across the causeway between their bedrooms, because there's like a long distance between the two of them, as they point out later on.
Well, then he says that horrible thing about how every time I look at him, I'm reminded of that one moment of weakness.
Right? Wow. Wow. Yeah, that is one of my favorite things in the movie, Lisa, because it's like, and because our love is so weak, that's why our son Reynard is such a wormy little disappointment.
Oh my God.
He is just unpleasant. And, oh, I get sick riding in the carriage, Father. Oh,
yeah. Oh, Lord.
Oh yes, Reynald is child actors in that period, they had it was a thankless performance anyway, because it seemed like they just had one mode, and that mode was dreadful. But yeah, Barbara O'Neill, we find out that she's indifferent to her children, could not care less if they were in the room or not.
She'd rather than not be. I mean, don't touch me, kid. Don't kiss me. You know, why don't you kiss your mom? No, let's not have him do that.
No, it's sticky. But what's really funny is I wouldn't say she ever starts caring about her children, but she gets infuriated at the thought of anyone else who's not directly under her control mattering to the children. So she's got a jealous streak that's a mile wide.
She's possessive.
I don't think she would care. I don't think she would even care if it was somebody under her control. I think if that other lady who then becomes her handmaiden had the actual affection of her children, she'd hate that lady just as much. The only reason she's still okay with her is because her kids can't stand her.
That's true. I think she also figures out that Charles Boy and Bette Davis like each other before they even figure it out. And she has a finely honed sense of grudgery, and she knows Charles Boyer doesn't like her, and she knows that this woman is, Bette Davis is set out to be considerably younger than the Barbara O'Neill character. There's not that much difference in their actual ages.
Yeah, really?
And again, I think Barbara O'Neill looks great, but I think Bette Davis is supposed to be playing a lot younger than she actually is.
The other question I have, and this may sound unfair, did they ask Barbara O'Neill to gain weight, do you think? Because they keep dressing her like somebody who is supposed to be physically past her prime. And she keeps being shot like she's a woman mm-hmm. with a double chin, when in fact she was not a woman with a double chin.
No, and I think that's to make her look, she and Charles Boyer look like an older couple, and Bette Davis to be the younger interloper. Again, they're all, you know, the women are very close in age, and the oldest child is what, 14?
14 or so.
Right. And so, yes, certainly people married at young ages, but I think Barbara O'Neill is supposed to we're supposed to have the impression she's pushing 40, but then they do a close up on her face and it's like, she looks great.
Yeah, yeah.
Honestly, I think she looks better than Bette Davis, but maybe that's just me.
I agree.
They give Bette Davis a really terrible hairstyle through all of it. It's just
awful.
Oh yeah. The thing about the more I watch this movie, the sorrier I actually feel for Frances, the Duchess of Praline, just because we're never explicitly told what repelled her husband so much. And she's set up from the word go to be a terrible mother and a terrible and indifferent person. And the deck is stacked against her in this movie, period. And there's not a lot of... Honestly, someone like her in that household would have had more servants on her side, because the only people who would have successfully stayed employed would have been the ones that would have avoided Madame's wrath. And for her to lose as much power as she did, as rapidly as she did, and to be so helpless to stop it. And again, terrible person, no insight whatsoever. She's pitiable.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, the other problem I had watching this was just, you know, and this is my own problem watching it from 2021 with all of my knowledge of mental health and the way that that should actually be treated. Guess what? It's not just like, you know, take their children away and give them everything else they want except for love and attention. I kept thinking like, okay, so this is loosely based on a true story. If that woman was actually even remotely like this, then yeah, pitiable is the right term, because she is suffering from some terrible mental health issues and has absolutely no support system whatsoever. And that kind of broke my heart a little bit. So it just like it and the fact that she's putting on the biggest performance in the entire movie by so much. Like, she kept drawing my eye and then was also sort of drawing my heart, even though she technically isn't supposed to be. I'm supposed to be feeling, I think, more warm fuzzies toward Charles Boyer. And then he turns out to be a terrible murderer. Yeah, he's awful.
In another framing, this movie is a horror story, and the monster is Charles Boyer. Yeah. No, it's like, you know what? You know what'll chase away those blues? Me being withholding. So you get to it.
That's the first scene where Charles Boyer and Betty Davis's characters meet. That's the scene where you're supposed to go, oh, something's going to be going on with these two. But Barbara O'Neill, not because she steals the scene, although she does, but because of the script, because of what she's actually given to do, as Erica says, she draws your eye, she draws your attention. And she's just, but she's over the top horrible, the line she has toward her kids. And in that moment, you don't really understand exactly what her relationship with her husband is. You just know that she's a cold fish when it comes to her kids, and ew, get away from me. And yeah, I think it seems to me that it's the production code's limitations or lack of imagination in terms of the script that prevents us from understanding what keeps Charles Boyer away from her. Because on one level, you could go, well, she's terrible. She's mean to those kids and she doesn't like them. So why would Charles Boyer pay any attention to her? But it feels like there's something deeper, and we don't get to investigate that, because it has to do with them not sleeping together. And except it happened once, and they mention it, but they don't explain it because the production code doesn't let them. But we're supposed to know what happened. But we don't.
He does mention, the only thing that he actually says is he goes on a little bit of a tirade about her jealousy, and it's how it's like her jealousy that has made her more and more angry, and that has pushed him away and thus made him more and more angry. And yeah, and I don't necessarily buy that as a legit answer. Maybe after being married to a woman like that for however, you know, 14 plus years, I mean, maybe that would drive me mad too. I don't know, but it did seem a little thin.
Yeah, it's a lot. It's a lot. And we're intended instantly to feel sorry for poor Charles Boyer. And especially because through most of the relationship, through most of the movie, his relationship with Betty Davis it's naive, but it's not, they're not having an affair. But he's very naive about not only how it looks, but about what could come of it. And my favorite part, of course, is like after she leaves the house and she's living in, you know, poverty, and he doesn't know that. But he just brings the kids by on occasion. You know, what could possibly go wrong with that? I mean,
naive is a good word.
I don't think he really thinks of her as a person. My problem with the quote unquote love story at the center of this movie, because I'll admit the first time I watched it, I'm like, this is a ridiculous melodrama. I must see it through to the end. but you're looking at when I was watching subsequent viewings of the movie, I don't think he loves her. I think he just wants a break. And she is the exact opposite of his wife. She doesn't have any leverage over him, financial, social, or otherwise. She likes his children and nurtures them. So she makes him feel better about his own parenthood or lack thereof. Because he's not really father of the year until she shows up. She's undemanding. And best of all, he knows she has to stay undemanding. So for him, it's just a super easy escape valve. And then for her, she's basically an orphan, and she talks a lot about how she doesn't get to have happiness of her own. She has crumbs of other people's happiness, and you know, she pretends other people's children are her own. So he's a proxy for the life that they're each other's fantasy proxies. It's a terrible love story. They don't ever really love each other for who they are. And Charles Boyer as the Duke is just dreadful.
At least he does care about her enough, or maybe he does just care about the idea of her enough, but he takes poison at the end rather than give her up.
That's just the melodrama talking. Because that whole end is, as I said, it's just plastered together. It's like, okay, we have to get out of this somehow, and that's how it feels. Everything from the point at which she's put on trial and then he takes poison, which doesn't kill him instantly. He gets essentially a death scene with her, and then she goes away and he's still alive, but then he dies. It's just like the whole thing is, I mean, the movie's overlong as it is, but that part just it's weird. But that analysis of his character is really interesting, because I guess I was sort of taking it for granted that on whatever limited terms this movie makes it possible, that he loved her. But you're right, because before she comes, I mean, he's busy being a peer, and he's avoiding his wife to a large extent by doing his peer business and government business. He's not exactly spending a lot of time in the nursery with the kids. I think they say at some point, you know, you came to see us like you used to. So at some point, maybe he did, but he's not really as much in the children's lives as you like to think he is once he and Betty Davis basically start co-parenting his kids.
And Betty Davis's character too. The whole movie, I can't figure out if her passivity is this whole, well, I'm an orphan and I'm being buffeted about by my social betters, and so I won't ever act for myself. But like, honestly, the hero of this movie is the landlady, who like takes Charles Boyer aside and is like, you never thought to question what she's actually doing. Let me tell you what your hag wife failed to do for her. And that's where they're compelled to act, because Lord knows Betty Davis isn't doing it for herself. She's happy just to be like, oh, you remember that I love flowers, and now back to the attic bedroom I haven't paid for in 8 months.
Yeah, but the action that's spurred on is murder, which leads to everything falling apart. So I'm not sure hero is the word I would use for that landlady.
I also love the landlady when the murder is discovered and the gendarmes show up. She is walking up the stairs howling about scandal, murder! We should all have someone like that in our lives. You just like pre-announce what is happening.
Also, really, I'm just going to assume it's accurate, but I do enjoy the 19th century gendarme outfits. I mean, to see somebody carted off to jail between two guys with those hats and those swords, it's pretty awesome.
You assume it's accurate, and yet in IMDb Goofs, there is a very lengthy entry on someone who takes issue with how envelopes are used in this movie. That is not how they used envelopes in 1840s France.
Oh my God, I love that there's a stationary nerd with history.
Yeah, no. I was just flipping through and I said, oh damn, that is someone who really passionately cares about how correspondence was sent in 1846.
I want that person to be my friend.
Yeah.
Yeah, I feel like there's a podcast they could probably be on at some point. Right. I'm not going to probably be on it, but... Well, let us talk about the children, shall we?
My daughter is disappointed none of them died.
I think I like your daughter. I will say that Virginia Weidler, who's one of my favorite child actresses, does not acquit herself particularly well in this movie. And I get strong Liesel from the Sound of Music vibes from that kid.
Yeah, she doesn't have a lot to do.
Are you talking Jean Lockhart?
Oh, yeah, right. I was transmogrifying my children.
Gotcha.
The June Lockhart is the Liesel vibes I get. Virginia Weidler is just kind of there. She doesn't have as much to do. She has a couple of interesting scenes, but she's far
more enthusiastic, at least.
If you want to, right. If you want to see Virginia Wilder at her best, just watch Philadelphia Story, as we did before.
Mm-hmm. Or yeah, watch The Women, where she's
a
little married.
Yes, yes, very much so.
Mm-hmm. I don't like child actors just in general. I think Lisa and I have that in common.
Yes, we do. I love it.
Yep. So honestly, I always assume I'm not going to like the child actors. And I feel like maybe I just didn't really even pay that much attention to them because you're talking about how terrible they were. And I'm like, were they? Oh, yeah. I guess
they were just generally annoying.
Honestly,
the
most exciting moment for me was when I finally pet like June Lockhart, because she looked so freaking familiar. And I was like, where do I know her from? And eventually, of course, I had to resort to IMDb because my brain just does not work that way. And I was like, oh, I was not expecting a crossover between All This in Heaven 2 and Babylon 5. Because, yes, June Lockhart is in an episode of Babylon 5, which is where I primarily know her from.
Wow.
Oh, that's so awesome. I was going to say Lost in Space. And no, you need even more nerdy. I love it.
June Lockhart is an absolute drip in this movie. And her only real, really good scene is when apparently the priest who hangs out at their estate and her grandfather explain to her the facts of life. I think that is a scene that I wish had not been left on the cutting room floor, because apparently it was quite a detailed and frank discussion about what she was going to be expected to do on her wedding night. And she
harrowing.
Is quite understandably upset by having this Cardinal Richelieu-looking dude like going in there. All that you do will be sin and awful, but you must persist. Think of Normandy, and that is her shining moment in the film. And then there's the youngest daughter, who's just absolutely forgettable.
Yeah, I have completely forgotten her. I can't even bring her face to my mind.
She exists. Well, again, it's like there's so many of them, and it's like they're a clump. They're together. And then we could talk about
there's the shame boy.
Yeah, we can talk about little Renald, who mom hates, the accident boy, and then he gets sick, and he's almost dies, which causes Charles Boyer to realize, yeah, maybe Bette Davis is a better choice for me because she saved my kid's life.
After my wife
taking him out for a walk.
Sick.
Right, yeah. By opening the window.
So when my wife takes the child out for a ride in the carriage, she sickens him. When Bette Davis takes him for a walk, he's okay. Okay.
That makes yes, total rigorous. Sense.
Mm-hmm. A child so dim-witted he is mystified by tangerines.
Talk about your sheltered upper-class children. Yes. That's a tangerine, dear.
I don't understand how it works.
Explain to me the tangerines, mademoiselle.
I can hear Erica shuddering from here. This is so
funny.
Yeah,
he was, you know what? I think I appreciate the fact that you guys are sort of giving me leave to feel my actual feelings about that kid, because I think as I was watching it, I was doing the thing I always do and being like, people like children. I should remember that. Okay. Yeah, he's kind of cute. But now that I'm thinking back, sure, his face is cute, but everything else is like just every word, every motion. Bad child actor. Bad. Bad.
No, I can't wait for the technology to replace the child actors. Oh my gosh, then they can go back. And you know how they once talked about colorizing Casablanca? I feel like you could retroactively go back and erase all the terrible child actors.
Oh, wow.
Ooh. Well, I really hate that like 1930s, 1940s child action actor diction, too.
Yeah, same. Where what they considered a good or a desirable child actor for these kinds of movies. I mean, this is done on purpose. This is not just an accidental bad actor.
No, like the diction is on purpose.
Yeah.
Oh, can I, like the tangerine, mademoiselle, like that sing-songy, weirdly rounded delivery. Oh, I loathe it. And that kid just kept going and going. Our daughter would come in periodically. Is he dead yet? He's still alive. Is he dead
again,
yet?
Why did we not have your daughter on the show? Because that would have been great.
I feel like next time we should.
I honestly thought he was going to die, too. And I didn't realize that he was going to live. And then that was going to spur on even more chaste love. Oh, and this is my head going, wait, this is based on a true story. There's no way they didn't get it on. Come on.
Right. 100%. Well, especially if Barbara O'Neill, you know, was being as much of a bitch as is implied that she is, Charles Boyer would just be like, oh my God, I need some relief. I need somebody to hold me.
I just need somebody to be calm around.
Right. Somebody who won't absolutely lose their crap. And yeah. Yeah. I thought the kid might die too, if only because his illness, not only did it go on so long, but it had so many phases. It's not just that it took up a number of minutes, but okay, first he's weak, and he, you know, he starts out, he's sickly, right? And then he gets sick, and then they're giving him the last rites, and then there's the whole okay, let's open the window and let him look out, and that'll fix him, but he's not alive yet. It takes forever for that kid to recover.
Yeah, well, I blame the doctor, who is literally just I can't do anything.
Right?
I'll come back in the morning and see if he's dead or not.
You know, they call them doctor's hours because they end at 3 o'clock every day. You can't summon us after that.
Mm-hmm. Well, if you're a peer, you can get off of a murder charge, but you can't get a doctor that will actually fix your kid.
Look, I did a chateau call. That's all I'm really doing.
They have I feel like it says volumes that they have a cardinal on staff, but they can't have a doctor nearby.
Yeah, there's a lot of Catholicism in this movie that, again, I think feels a little half-baked, because it feels to me as if it probably was really important to either the true story or the novelization. Mm-hmm. And of course, they're in France, so that certainly they're Catholic. But it felt like that the cardinal is both deployed as Barbara O'Neill's, you know, confessor and friend, and also sort of a source of this is the church, this is the law. Although her father, Barbara O'Neill's father figure, is far more intimidating and scary than the priest ends up being. But it feels like two halves of the same coin.
Like maybe the priest is her minder when dad can't be around.
I guess so.
Because the implication is that she's a handful.
Right. Well, and given how the movie ends, I'm just imagining those kids going to live with the father, and it just sounds terrifying. Ugh. And I don't even like the kids, but even so.
The actor who plays the dad is named Montague Love, and I think that is the most delightful name in history.
That's like a silent movie name. I always see that, and I think he must have been some sort of silent movie actor.
And apparently his real name, not like a stage name.
Oh, that was going to be my next comment, was that sounds like a name made up in a publicity office.
It was not.
He was born Montague Love.
It's too perfect for a publicity office.
And yet he kept it. Mm-hmm. Well, let's see. What else? We have lots of production values. We have costumes. As you say, I don't think Betty Davis is well served by her hairdo. The costumes are, you know, they are what they are because she's not wealthy.
Oh, boy, did they stack the deck against Barbara O'Neill here, too, because it's just a lot of ruffles all the time. And it's meant to make her look fretful and enormous and out of fashion. And boy, howdy, like every time she's on screen, I'm like, I wonder if that poor actress like went home every night. I hate this job. I hate this job. I hate this job.
You do kind of wonder that. Either she loved it or she hated it. She loved it because she got to chew the scenery and be crazy. Because, I mean, imagine if you're an actor, like, you're in a secondary part. You don't get to look. You're not the star person. You don't get to be Betty Davis. You're well paid and all that. But at least if you get to it's a showy part, but she doesn't get to look her best in it.
Yeah.
I mean, I would argue it's a better part for her than the mother in Gone with the Wind, even, because that's like a pitiless sort of, you're wringing your hands the whole time, and then you're going to die. Well, you're going to die in this movie, too, but your death scene's going to be much more interesting.
Yeah.
Charles Boyer is going to wring your neck.
Yeah. You don't get upstaged by your daughters in this movie.
No! Exactly. And you're not...
Can we also talk about the pastor and how... Phil, you said something at dinner I think you should explicate a little bit more here, too, because we were talking about this movie at dinner, and the drippy pastor who's...
Part of
the framing device.
Oh, yeah.
This
is the greatest argument for Protestantism since the 95 Theses, because basically you have this pastor who shows up and he's all, hey, I'll give you a new life and come with me. And then you have every priest in the movie that you see is just a stern, unfriendly person who scares your daughter about tales with what's going to happen to her on her wedding night. So, yes, I was big fan of the priest or the pastor.
He exists to sort of save Betty so that she can survive at the end. He's there to catch her when, you know, she has to leave France and she gets a job and the mean girls are going to chase her out of that job. But he's there waiting for her, and, you know, presumably they're going to get married. And it may not be as hot as it was with Charles Boyer, but at least she'll have a nice home in America.
Yeah, we not only know that she lands on her feet, but we know how it happens because we meet him so early in her story. It's before she even gets to France. You know, she meets him on the boat and we're like, oh, it's that guy. We know him because we just saw him in the, you know, the part before the flashback. And obviously he's going to show up again. But like his showing up again feels super random and tacked on. Yes. Like he just happens to find her in the jail and just like Deus Ex Machina, Protestant Deus Ex Machina.
Well, it is weird because when we first see him in the before the flashback begins, I'm not even sure why he's there. Like, he's a friend of hers because she goes to the headmistress basically to say, I quit. The mean girls are chasing me away. And he's there and he's like, try again. It'll be okay. And I'm like, who is this guy? And then pretty soon.
Where do you get off?
Yeah, and then pretty soon we see him again, and it's like, okay, so clearly they have some sort of relationship, and he's going to be back to fix things at the end of the movie. But you're right, he totally feels tacked on, and he's not very interesting either.
And he's just there, as you say, in the introduction. He's there in the first scene of the flashback, and then he doesn't show up until she's in jail at the end. And it's, oh, where have you been the last 2 hours and 20 minutes of this, right. of this dog?
He's doing his grand tour to get his experience so he can do better sermons. Like, they lay that out on the boat.
But he was in France the whole time doing stuff.
How many sermons do you think he said, when I was in France, I saw the most, every week I bet, I thought the prisoners will be sitting there going, oh God, here we go, another story about France.
Yeah.
Oh, Lord.
He's going to explain how in the Normandy region they drink apple brandy instead of wine. Here we go.
And he's like, you know, everybody
the north part of the
Catholic.
Country is very, likes matters. In the south country, they're more laid back. We get it, dude. Yes. And your sermon.
Yeah. Oh, well. Oh, no, he's kind of a drip. I mean, I applaud him for coming to see her in jail and all that. But like when your sales pitch to the woman you're wooing is, well, it's not dramatic, but aren't you tired of the drama? And you just see her sigh and look out the window and you're like, right on, we're engaged. Like, that's just sad.
I feel like it.
I'm never going to have to drink poison for you, baby.
Yeah.
It's almost
I
like.
I don't have a crazy wife waiting for me. Mm-hmm.
It's almost like he's her punishment. Like, she didn't actually do anything, you know, really wrong in this movie. And yet she gets punished with this guy at the end. Like, it didn't feel like an actual happy ending. I mean, we finally get the title significance, All This in Heaven too. And I'm just like,
again, an argument for Protestantism.
And she's lost all the brats that she's loved. She loves as well as Charles Boyer, and again, whatever.
Like, she feels like a whole new classroom of brats, like that scene at the end where they're like, "But we love you," and I was like, "Oh, come on!
Yeah, why?
You've known her for 20 minutes.
You've been sitting there for 2 hours listening to her tell this story without benefit of all the costumes and the score and everything. But they love her now. Even these mean girls who are really, really mean. Like when they start out, they don't even really have. Most of them don't know the story. Like the alleged story of this woman with a past gets passed along, but they're mean before they even know what the story is. They're hardcore.
I honestly thought that because, you know, one of the girls, the real, really mean one, says, you know, my mom's like, maid or whatever has all these papers and stuff. Like the fact that she mentioned her mother, I at first, because she was so mean about it, I thought that this girl's mother had been somehow involved and her mother was like wronged or scorned in some way. And that's why she was being so terribly mean about it. And as the movie progresses, I'm like, oh no, this has nothing to do with anybody from America. Those girls are just awful.
The whole bit at the end, but we love you. And I'm like, you know who has that kind of rapid conversion rate? Cult members. Show me the movie where Betty Davis is recruiting for a cult, because that is the one I want to see. Like her giant Francophile cult of upper class New York schoolgirls.
I'd watch that.
Would watch.
Yes, in a heartbeat.
Would watch. Well, what loose ends have we not tied into knots, so to speak? What have we missed that we need to talk about?
I was grossed out by the fact that there were like disgusting bloody handprints on the wall. Like, in that moment that Charles Boyer, like, finally loses it, I'm thinking, okay, he strangles her to death. But that is not what happened.
No,
there's blood everywhere.
We were debating that over dinner, too.
Like,
because we were like, because I said, oh, then he beat, because Beatrix is like, so how does the movie end? I said, oh, well, he finally snaps and and it's like the Duke finally snaps and beats the Duchess to death. And Phil's like, no, she got strangled. And I was like, but there was blood.
I think it started with a strangling. That's my guess. Yeah. And then right, she managed to get away,
I think,
and that
it was
made him mad.
Multiple methods, because it's clear that he grabbed her by the throat. But then they show the handprints, and then they talk about it later that there's blood everywhere.
So, like, he must have just flung her around the room like the Hulk with Loki at the end of Avengers. It's just dreadful to think about.
He could have found some sort of stabby weapon. I mean, they're in her bedroom. They're probably stabby.
I mean, maybe she tried to fight back and then ended up getting stabbed with it. Why am I even thinking about this? Stop. I don't need it.
Well, I think you'll find in 1840s Europe, they did not use letter openers.
Thanks, IMDb goofs section, which I didn't read for this one. Sometimes I do, but I didn't read that one, and I'm glad about that.
It's a much better reveal on the podcast, to be honest.
I agree. I absolutely agree. Thank you for that, Phil. You've uplifted the dialogue.
No problem.
Well, thank you all for joining me for All This in Heaven 2, a movie which we can't unconditionally recommend, but do see Barbara O'Neill and The Toy Wife. That's an advanced course. Let me tell you, if you are a classic film aficionado.
The Toy Wife has my unqualified recommendation. See it and live your life according to its teachings.
I'm just saying, be aware of what you're getting into as much as you possibly can, because that is some movie. Whew, The Toy. I'd seen it. But I watched it because we were having a conversation about Barbara O'Neill in preparation for watching this movie. And you all reminded me of The Toy Wife. And so I was just sitting there on a Saturday afternoon minding my own business. And I put it on. And I was like, oh, this one. Oh, my.
I like how you put that, because really The Toy Wife just does kind of sneak up on you and mug you.
It kind of does.
Seen it. Yeah, because you're like, oh, it's just, it's hoop skirts and people being excited about a relative coming to visit. Then you're
No,
this is so much better than that.
It's very gothic. It's, I'm getting the vapors.
Yes.
Wow.
Lisa, Phil, Erica, thank you all for joining me for this delightful, start that again.
you'll fix it in post-production.
I'm totally leaving this in. Lisa, Phil, and Erica, thank you so much for joining me to talk about All This in Heaven 2. If you want to keep up with this show, and why wouldn't you, please go to theincomparable.com/LTS. You can also follow us on Twitter at Lion Tower Shield, because S's cost extra. You can follow me personally at Shelley, S-H-E-L-L-Y, and tell me what movies we should be watching and also how the French dealt with post in the 1840s. Bye now!